the financial plan has to follow the person and their life planning. It has to follow the arc of their life and the what makes them them. Because, you know, if somebody, you can build the, you know, the fanciest, most elegant financial plan in the world, but if it doesn't track the client's lived experiences, then it's useless. It's not, you know, it's just numbers on a page.
The heart of advice. It's personal. It's pragmatic. Here on the eMoney Heart of Advice podcast, we explore how to navigate both sides to help you take your financial planning practice to the next level. Join us as we speak with financial professionals to learn how they deepen relationships and improve client outcomes. This podcast contains purely educational information, and nothing discussed may be construed as legal, tax, or financial advice. Please consult a financial advisor for any financial investment or money management questions. All views or opinions represented are solely the opinion of the speaker and do not represent those of eMoney Advisor or any of its affiliates or subsidiaries.
Welcome to the Heart of Advice podcast, presented by eMoney. I'm Sasha Grabenstetter.
And I'm Connor Sung. We're your eMoney experts. Today on the podcast, we have Max Mintz. Max Mintz is a partner and financial planner at Common Interests, an advisory firm that's a certified B Corp and based in Metuchen, New Jersey. Max was named to the Investment News 40 Under 40 list in 2019, partnered with the Wall Street Diversity Accelerator, which is an internship program for students. Max, you had quite a unique path to becoming a financial planner. Can you tell us a little bit about your interests, your skills, kind of how you got to where you are at today?
Sure, Connor, and thank you guys for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm not your traditional financial planner by any stretch of the imagination. I have my background goes back to, you know, an engineering high school, doing social advocacy work and, you know, teen sexual health and alcohol work in high school. I come from a tradition of, you know, my mom was a sort of a social activist. My dad was in tech, and I sort of marry those two, threads together. I went to Rutgers University here in New Jersey, where I majored in philosophy and religion. So how did I end up as a financial planner? Well, my parents had found out a financial planner who matched their values, who specialized in responsible investing. And you know, this was back in the 90s when it wasn't quite as big a field as it is now. So they found a local advisor, a local financial planner, CFP, who was a fit for them. And he had some health trouble. One year, he pushed a piece of paper across the desk at their annual review and said, "Hey, I'm looking for an associate, looking for somebody who can be my apprentice, who can learn the business, who I can teach everything I know to, and who can be my, you know, maybe be my successor at some point." And it had a list of attributes, no skills, no knowledge, no nothing, but a list of attributes of the person that he was looking for. And my mom looked up and said, "Well, that sounds like Max." And Bob, who was my financial planner as well, you know, he had my UTMA account and had helped me, you know, start to learn about what is investing and how do we build wealth and magic of compound interest and all that good stuff. And so he, you know, we went out to lunch and he pushed a piece of napkin across the table at me. And he said, "Max, I'm offering you two options here. One is a job. If you want to come here, you can learn how to use Morningstar and learn how to do financial planning. And you can, you know, come push paper around a desk and be my assistant. And that's a choice, right? You can do that. Or if you decide to, it could be your career." And I wrestled with that for a long time. I didn't know if this was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. But through Bob's, he trusted me to follow my own passions and to be intellectually curious about the nature of our work. And that led me down a road towards understanding what is values-aligned investing. How do we invest in a way that we're really comfortable with, where we are understand the investments in our portfolio, the role that they have to play, but also their impact on society and on the planet. And through just being intellectually curious, going deeper and not accepting kind of the marketing BS that we see from a lot of places, it's led me into some really interesting places, hence all the, you know, nonsense you said at the beginning. So thank you for that. And now here we are 10 years later and I'm working on my CFP. So not a CFP professional yet, but hopefully in the next year or two, you'll be able to say that.
Keep on keeping on. It is, we talked to a few people about that notion, which it sounds like you learned it pretty early about that you can teach all of these skills. Like you could sit somebody down, you can teach them how to use trading platforms, technology, how to do some of the administrative tasks, but you can't teach values. And it sounds like the values that you had instilled from your upbringing, your parents, some of the stuff that you were into when you were going get your undergrad, that it aligned extremely well with the gentleman that you, it sounds like, kind of mentored you through some of the financial planning that you do today. And it's pretty cool that you were able to have that experience that early on. And now it sounds like now that you use it as part of your, core of your practice.
Absolutely. In fact, for me, I would not be here today. I would not be a financial planner without that. It is values first, right? And that does definitely flow through to my philosophy around financial planning, right? The numbers, the charts, the pretty pictures, the fancy toys that you guys give me, those are in support of the plan, right? I often have conversations with clients where I say, look, we're going to talk about numbers. We're going to, look at Monte Carlo projections. We're going to talk about risk. Those things are all critically important, but all of those things are in service to you, in service to your life planning. And, we will talk about what's possible, what's necessary, what we can and can't do, what's reasonable. But the first step is to sort of put our feet up and say, when we're doing retirement planning, for instance, right? I want to make sure that my clients have something to retire to, not just something to retire from, right? And that's led us deeper and deeper into the psychology of money, the emotions, even the spirituality around money. So that's sort of where we're putting a lot of our efforts right now.
Well, Max, you're speaking my language, especially in financial wellness where I sit in e-money. When we're speaking of values, e-money has done some research on the financial planning process that shows how personalization is an important way to provide more value to clients. And obviously, it doesn't get more personalized than values aligned investing and what you said is customized private placements and high impact. So can you describe a few examples of these types of investments and how your firm facilitates them?
Yeah, sure. I think it's always important at this point in the conversation to start defining terms and talk about where we are and where we're headed, right? So when we talk about sustainable investing or values-based investing more generally, often the letters ESG will come up, right? And we'll talk about the difference between sort of risk management using environmental, social, and governance data points to help manage risk in a portfolio around the sort of extra financial stuff, right? But when we start talking about values-based investing or impact, right, we're talking about either removing things from the portfolio that are at odds with our clients' values, or overweighting things that are more aligned with their values, right? In the public space, right? So if we're talking about investing in public equities, I would say we're probably not creating a ton of impact there, right? We're really the goal there is to deliver a portfolio that enables the client to engage with their financial plan. Oftentimes when I'm working with younger clients, there's a certain level of people being sort of disaffected, right? Not having a lot of trust in the system. And what I'll see is a lot of times people say, well, finance is kind of esoteric. It's kind of built to be confusing. The jargon we use, the, modern portfolio theory statistics, right? All that stuff is important, but it is intimidating. And so being able to work with a client and make sure that they know that their portfolio is aligned with their values enables them to engage better with their planning. I've seen cases where clients who don't want to engage with finance, they feel left out. They feel like it's not something for them. Like they can't, it's not accessible. Once we start having these conversations and we start really showing them data around the sustainability metrics in their portfolios, they're able to engage in a different way. It takes away a certain level of that fear, right? When we start talking about impact, that's when I start to get into a deeper definition, something called additionality. I'm going to betray the fact that I was a philosophy major here, right? Because I'm going to ask a counterfactual question. Additionality asks, what happened that we can measure because my client took action, which would not have happened without that action or investment, right? That's the highest level of impact I've found so far, or highest definition of impact. And it's very hard to do. It's very hard to deliver. oftentimes those investments occur off the private markets. You're talking about private placements, right? Typically are only accessible by accredited investors or qualified purchasers. And that sucks, right? Most of my clients are not accredited investors. And so, you know, I'll see, you know, deals coming through our broker dealer that, you know, sound really awesome and are really cool, but, you know, aren't worth working on because my clients can't play ball, right? They can't get into them. So it's only in recent years when things like Reg A, Regulation A, crowdfunding, Regulation CF have come to market where we're able to access private placements that are available to non-accredited investors. We worked on a couple of them. One was a recycling company here in New Jersey that recycles the unrecyclable, has a really interesting business model where they basically function as an ad agency, and they use to fund recycling of materials that wouldn't be economically viable without an additional revenue stream, right? That was a really cool investment, and a lot of my clients are, you know, the clients who were interested in it, you know, and who were willing to accept illiquid positions and things like that. We're very excited. The other really interesting one was a lumber investment where we were working with the world's fastest growing hardwood tree. And it had a really interesting structure where we were partnering with small local farmers who had land that was sort of had been depleted by traditional farming methods. It didn't have a lot of nutrients in it, couldn't really be used. And these trees are really cool. They return nitrogen to the soil. They are regenerative. So you, in order to maximize the sort of carbon capture element of this, you have to cut them down so that they regrow from the stump, right? And we built a, there was a revenue split. So if there's any profits from the deal, once they've sold the lumber, the revenue gets split 50% to the farmers, and then the other 50% is split between the sponsor and the investor. So for every dollar that our investors take home in profit, a farmer will take home $2. So it's those types of structures that enable us to say, look, because you invested and planted an acre of trees, we know that, you know, X pounds of carbon will be captured out of the atmosphere. We know that a farmer will take home $2 in profit for every dollar you take home. And we know that they can do things like intercrop with other products, you know, coffee or bananas or things like that underneath. And we're actually regenerating soil. So we were able to give actual impact statements, impact certificates out to our clients that says, here are our projections for what's going to happen. And the company, the sponsor, has been keeping up with measuring the, you know, diameter of the trees so that our clients know, you know, just how much carbon has actually been captured, whether we're actually hitting those projections. So this has been really cool.
That is so cool. I'm going to steal the word additionality. And I think it, well, number one, it fits extremely well with a lot of the research eMoney has done around engagement and collaborative planning. So I think this aspect of collaborative investing or, you know, just the engagement and building the portfolio around their values and impact, it's a really cool way to keep people involved in their financial life and not just building the, you know, kind of the values-based stuff that you were talking about, a portfolio that leads to, you know, a successful plan, but you're able to offer people that additional like monetary or mental monetary, that kind of gratification that you're not able to associate with, I think, any most portfolios. And just even my own, you know, kind of side account, I found myself investing in companies that I either, you know, really enjoy their products or I really enjoy what they do at a, you know, kind of a base mission and vision level. And I've found that I look at them differently because it's less about the actual monetary return that I get. And it is more about the kind of the impact that they have across, you know, any number of things, whether that's, you know, the environment, recycling, lumber, like they're, and whatever you're into, there are opportunities to find ways to relate client values into some sort of return. And then you going kind of that next step and helping tell that story of, you know, the carbon offset that you had based on the diameter of the tree trunk, like that, it tells a holistic story and has zero to do with their financial plan success.
Except I can't not jump in on that. So you give me the perfect thing here, right? So think about your behavior as an investor in that case, right? We know, and your research has borne this out, that actual investors' returns differ significantly from the returns of the market, primarily due to buying and selling decisions at the wrong time, right? If an emotional connection to your portfolio enables you to stay invested through market volatility, that has a dramatic impact on the probability of success of your plan. And it's what's more, it's something we can't capture in planning software, right? It says it's something that will, like, it actually brings our hopeful projected results closer to the actual projections in the software, right? So that's, I don't know how to measure that. And if you guys can measure it, I would be grateful. That would be that, that's part of my theory. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the never-ending curve of fear, buy, sell, and the behavior gap. But I do like that that stance. Well, so we are talking quite a bit about values, and I know even you mentioned not having something retire from, but having something to retire to. Your firm has a unique way of onboarding to get to those values pretty early on in the process. Can you just talk a little bit about what that client experience is?
Yeah, I'll have to mention another one of my partners at this point, because I've worked very closely with a platform called yourstake.org to build out our onboarding process, because we work in two paths, sort of in parallel. One is the eMoney onboarding process, right? Working with a client to identify the financial goals. The second is through Yourstake, where we have a pair of tools, either a behavioral finance, sort of a behavioral values assessment tool, and the other is a more in-depth sort of values picker, where the client takes a sort of guided journey through what matters to them, prioritizing and deprioritizing different parts of sustainability. One of the challenges in sustainable investing is there are too many data points, right? I think in our systems, we have something like 250 or 300 individual data points that we can report back on. And that's just overwhelming. So we need to filter it down to something that our clients can really engage with so that it matters to them. Some of those data points, by the way, are also diametrically opposed, pro and anti certain positions, right? As fiduciaries, it's not our job to tell our clients what to believe. It's to facilitate investments that are in line with their values, not ours. So, there are things in the systems that, I don't believe, but some of my clients do, and that's their right. So we work in parallel. Right, we work to understand the financial plan and the values and see how the two fit together, and we're able to deliver now consolidated reporting around sort of the both the risk levels and the values alignment of those portfolios. What we do is we sort of create personas, right? Something like a planet protector or a peace defender, human rights advocates, things like that, and we're able to show people overall within these groups of sort of sustainability personas, how well their current portfolio aligns, if they're investing themselves or they have a different advisor, and how our proposal would move them in a direction that's more appropriate for them. From there, there's a choice, right? The question becomes, how deep does the client want to go? How engaged did they want to be in the sustainability profile of their portfolio? Some people come to me and they're delegators, right? They want to delegate that to me. They learn who I am. They learn about my background, sort of who I am and what I believe. And they say, yeah, cool. We're in for that, right? I have a series of model portfolios that I use that express sort of our house view on sustainability. Yourstake gives me some tools that allow me to find alternatives at different asset classes. This gets kind of wonky, right? Where we say, like, okay, if I have a large cap growth position and the client has expressed values that are slightly different than what's in the model, I can find alternates with mutual funds or ETFs that allow us to move the portfolio in a closer direction while still allowing me to, be a nerdy asset allocator and, keep that all, not break the scalability of my practice, basically. But some clients come to me and they say, look, I don't want any of this, right? I want to go deep. I want to understand what's going on. I want the fixed income portion of my portfolio to be completely in relatively high impact things. And it is actually possible to deliver additionality in the bond markets, right? Through direct lending. There are a ton of new impact bonds coming to market that are rated, publicly available. And, we have great support through our broker dealer to gain access to new issuances. So those things go in the portfolios as they come up for those clients. But for the client who says, look, I really want to go deep. I want to understand every single stock in my portfolio, right? Well, mutual funds and ETFs are kind of out, right? Like, you know, you're really outsourcing that decision-making process to a manager, and you've got to understand the manager's theories and their philosophy on these things. And those things can and do change, right? We see prospectus updates on a regular basis where people are changing what the screens are in their portfolio, right? Some of the older investment managers in the SRI space have done this recently. So for them, we did it a different solution. Those have to be highly customized portfolios. And some of the new advances in fractional share trading have enabled us to use direct indexing technologies at a much lower minimum than we used to have. So through the same vendor, through yourstake.org, we now have a direct indexing platform that's available at a $25,000 minimum, which is much, much more accessible than the hundreds and 250,000s of minimums that we used to see. So it becomes a sort of a bifurcated choice early on in the process, where we start thinking about investment actual management, where we decide, okay, well, we're either going to go in a sort of a model portfolio direction, where you've got me as a manager, it's very old school core and satellite management, you know, modern portfolio theory stuff, or are we going to go in a new sort of fancier direct indexing approach?
That's a lot.
Yeah. I have been accused by my staff of having far too complex an organization. They're not wrong. That's how my brain works.
No, but I think that's really fascinating to think about, like, the different types of clients that you have and how personalized you're getting. Like you said, like, there's those delegators who are like, just do it for me. Like, it's totally good. And then those people who are like, no, I want to know, like, what's then. And then the really deep people, like, that's, I think that's fascinating. So I think it's really cool. So
I do have a quick question, because I almost, the sustainability personas, do you come up with the names yourselves?
No, the folks at Yourstake did. They did a pretty good job. Okay. Right.
I almost imagine it being, you know, something that's near and dear to Sasha's heart, but being like Hogwarts houses and people like really getting into their, you know, their persona type.
Yeah, actually. So I have, because you asked, we actually have multiple platforms that do it in slightly different ways, right? So I primarily use this stuff through Yourstake because I really like their approach, right? They don't give ESG scores, right? Anytime you're looking at an ESG score, some analyst sitting at a desk somewhere has made some values decisions about what matters, right? There's always a weighting methodology that's usually like 200 pages long, right? That says like, okay, black box, right? Data points go in, something magic happens, score gets spit out, right? And that's where like a big part of the problem, the greenwashing problem, exists for me. So one of the reasons that I partnered with Yourstake is that they don't do that. They expose the actual underlying data that gives like an overweight or underweight to a benchmark kind of score, where it says like, okay, you're, you know, but then it also, you know, when we look at something that is maybe being penalized, right, maybe being being flagged as a concern, we then get to drill down into the reasons that the concern is being flagged. And the client gets to make a decision about whether that's appropriate for them or not, right? Because, you know, a lot of times we'll talk about, say, like prison industry exposure, right? That's a big, big topic for us and for our clients. We will not own private prison operators in our portfolios. It's one of my hard values, like ethical screens. I simply will not play ball there, right? We actually just had to make a fairly major change to our portfolios because one of my small cap positions was holding a private prison company. Not only a private prison company, it was the private prison company that was managing the border facilities that were separating migrant kids from their parents, right? My clients view this as an ethical breach, right? This is unacceptable, and they work with me partially because I will not accept those companies in our portfolio. So I engaged with that manager for about a year. They refused to sell the position because of the way the index fund was constructed and the way the ESG scoring was occurring, right? So this really directly relates to that sort of black box issue. And so we had to replace that fund with another one to maintain, and we had to make a couple other tweaks to maintain our asset allocation, right? Other companies will also get flagged, right? Food service companies or mental health facilities or IT providers that provide, whose software is used in prisons and jails, right? And then my clients get to say, huh, well, I never thought about, you know, a big IT company as being exposed to the private prison industry. Well, okay, if, you know, Microsoft's Windows is used as an operating system in prisons, yes, technically that's an exposure. Do I really care? That's not my decision. That's my client's decision. That one's, you know, definitely pretty far to the fringe, right? But I do have some clients who say no exposure to private prisons whatsoever. That's their right. Although I will admit, the more companies like that you try to exclude, the higher the tracking error your portfolio will be from the benchmark, right? That's unavoidable.
But I think it's pretty fascinating, though, to like, once you're able to figure out what your clients' values are, like have those in-depth conversations. So one thing I wanted to talk about with you, Max, was, you know, I read online that you have a no minimum at your firm, and that really makes financial planning available to everyone. Can you share a little more about this for other advisors who may be kind of considering this type of fee structure?
Yeah. So, you know, many planners will have relatively high asset level minimums because in the planning space, the traditional billing methods are like AUM billing. Right. And if a client can't generate enough revenue for the firm to make serving them worthwhile, then that's a challenge. Right. So we have to look at alternative options for smaller clients to make it both cost effective for the small client and effective for the planner. So for smaller accounts, I do outsource management. Right. We use a turnkey asset management platform. Yes. More complexity, right? This is the downside. But we're working with a turnkey asset management platform that includes transaction costs in their asset billing, right? So those accounts do not generate much revenue for the firm, but they're hyper efficient for the clients who are trading in small dollar amounts, where if you have like any ticket charges or anything from your custodian, you know, if a client's putting $100 a month in, and even if you have like a $7 ticket charge, that's 7% for a single trade. Right? That doesn't work. Right? So we had to find an alternative, and we did. We have a TAMP, right? It enables us to run model portfolios or use third-party managers to get those clients investing on a dollar cost averaging basis, right? They're putting money in every month. And so when I run a fee analysis, it's like, oh, you're paying 5 cents a trade, right? If the client's putting $100 a month in and they're, you know, that's broken up into, you know, as a $5 minimum trade size. So, you know, you might have 10 trades a month, right? And the client's paying a fee. That fee then just covers the investment management side, right? We meet with the client once a year to review the portfolios, make sure those things are still going right and still aligned with their risk tolerance and plan. But then you really do need to charge separately for planning, right? And we're right now experimenting with retainer models. We also have a, for a long time, we've used a sliding fee scale based on our client's ability to pay. And for hourly work. And the theory there is I'm at the beginning of my career, right? I'm 36, I'm turning 37 next month. So I plan on being in this business for the next 30 or 40 years, right? My business partner retired when he was 80. So yeah, all right, I might have another 30 years in me. Cool. That means for me as a young planner, the most important asset I have is relationships. And building new relationships. And I see smaller investors, people who care, who really want to work the way I do, who understand the value of values-based investing, and who want financial planning, but who may not be at the asset levels where other planners are willing to work with them. I mean, that is an underserved market, right? I had to stop taking new clients temporarily this year because we had so much interest, and I simply didn't have the capacity. I'm one planner and I have two staff, but there's only so many hours in the day and I wasn't getting enough sleep. So there are definitely some challenges there. And as clients need more ongoing support, I think a retainer model with a monthly fee is a really, really great way to serve those clients, right? They get value for it. We're not working for pennies on the hour and everybody kind of wins because then you're winning those relationships as well.
It's mutually beneficial for sure, especially when you have the capacity to do it. And as you talked about a little bit, for underserved communities, underserved markets, there are, I think, sliding fee scales, hourly structures, some sort of retainer model for some of them. I really like the approach and the way that you're talking about that our relationships are the most important asset for you and to continue to build them, maintain them, and to retain them as you make your way through firm growth. But you've talked to our team before about your passion for delivering additional financial advice to historically underserved communities and markets. And that includes you as an advocate for pro bono financial planning. Can you talk a little bit about some of the programs that you've supported in the pro bono space?
Sure. So I like to find opportunities to work at scale, right? Where we're not using necessarily a one-to-one, but a one-to-many model. And so that means finding local local groups that already have built trust in their communities, churches, community centers, things, libraries, things like that, and leveraging their ability to reach the community to, you know, bring bodies through the door, to bring people in and to have them engage. And that means listening first. It means not just coming with a canned presentation of what I want to talk about, right? Here's financial planning 101. Here's the magic of compound interest. Okay, well, if people can't put food on the table, then that doesn't matter, right? You need to understand what the stakeholders you're working with need from you, what the needs are in the community. And start by just listening, by asking and listening. And people will tell you. And then you can craft a program that meets those needs with the knowledge that we have as financial planners. And you people will get excited about it, and they will become advocates to bring people through the door. And then once you do some presentations and you talk to people, you will develop a reputation in the community. And that's what's happened with us, right? People still come in the door, you know, hey, I bought this annuity. What is this, right? You know, is this actually a fit for my goals? Okay, well, now we got to talk about this. Why do you want an annuity and you're on food stamps, right? Like, this is not okay. So, those are good examples. I also think we need to solve the pipeline problem in the industry, right? We are still a primarily pale, stale, male industry, right? To steal from a good friend who coined that phrase. And so that means we need to create a pipeline of financial planners who don't look like me, right? I need to use my firm as a pipeline to bring more people into the industry who can also serve more clients, right? And that's why the partnership with the WSDA internship is so important to us, right? We recruit from historically Black colleges and universities and partner with asset management firms and financial planning firms to offer, you know, 6-week paid internships. I do believe that a paid internship is a critical portion of that because many people from historically underserved communities do not have the resources to take an unpaid internship. Right. And so we pay a living wage. We don't offer benefits because it's a 6-week internship, but we do pay and we do bring them in and have them sit in client meetings. And they come out of the interns come out of the program with just their eyes open. It's really incredible. And I hope to be sort of hiring out of those pools and building a talent pool that can do something really interesting. Many of them. In fact, I just met with one of our old interns a couple weeks ago, and you know, she's now at Morgan Stanley in their wealth management track. So it's really, really cool to see.
I know that Max, you and I have worked a lot with the WSDA, like, you know, partnering with eMoney and getting those interns kind of access to the software, really understanding how that works. And so to hear a little bit more about the program, it's inspiring, of course. But, you know, just also hearing your love of pro bono, which obviously, again, I'm in the financial wellness space, really enjoy that. And, you know, we're really working on some pieces there. So I'm really excited to hear like how the pipeline comes along, especially because we do need it. Yeah.
Yeah. I do also try to take at least 2 or 3 pro bono cases a year personally. You know, we have, and they tend to be people who have a dramatic need, right? You know, somebody whose spouse passed away suddenly without life insurance, and now there's a critical need. Somebody, you know, people who work at a nonprofit and have some student loans and are struggling under the debt, and I can, you know, talk to them about public service loan forgiveness, and, you know, maybe they already qualify for it and just didn't even know about that stuff. So you can do a lot of good with not a lot of effort sometimes, just by bringing ideas to the table that people don't know exist.
And it really makes you like a more holistic, well-rounded advisor to have that knowledge and skill set. Because I a lot of advisors I hear, like, they don't know about debt management or payday loans or things like that. So I think that makes you a well-rounded advisor to have those conversations with those people who really do need it. So,
yeah. Yeah.
As we kind of round out the podcast, I just want to know, how would you define the heart of advice when it comes to financial planning? I would love to especially hear it from you, Max.
Oh, man, that I've been meditating on this. And that's a really, really hard question. But I'm going to come back to something I said kind of at the top of this recording, which is that the financial plan has to follow the person and their life planning, It has to follow the arc of their life and the what makes them them, right? Again, you know, when we work with a client around a retirement plan, we can't start by looking at the numbers and looking at the risk tolerance. We have to start by looking at the people. We have to start by looking at what drives them and who they really are. Because, you know, if somebody, you can build the fanciest, most elegant financial plan in the world, but if it doesn't track the client's lived experiences, then it's useless. It's not, you know, it's just numbers on a page. And so for me, it comes back to that emotional core. Who is that client? What are their core values? And how can we build a plan that supports that? Right. I've seen too many clients. Maybe it comes back to like some of my experiences early on as an advisor, where you have somebody, you know, who retires from a long career, very successful, and then they're just listless. They're just, you know, they don't have any purpose in life. And it's really disturbing to see. And many of these clients don't, we're the only person that they're willing to talk to about this because we are managing the money. Right. And we have a long relationship. But a lot of these clients don't have therapists. They don't have, you know, a support structure in their life where they're talking about this stuff. And so we found ourselves accidentally becoming financial therapists. And I'm not a financial therapist. I'm not qualified to be one. Maybe in the future when I'm done with my CFP, we'll talk about that. But I do think that the heart of advice these days is understanding not just modern portfolio theory and managing alpha and beta and all that good stuff. But it's about integrating the financial plan and the life plan and making sure that the clients can not just live and survive, but thrive. And again, you're going to hear me move in this direction where it's all about both the financials, but also the extra financial externalities. It's about the things that surround the plan, about what we're trying to help our clients achieve, and about where we're trying to help them go. You know?
Max, I think at the end of the day, you really get to know your clients, get to know their values, create those personalized portfolios, really work with individuals who need help, and you're making a difference in the field. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Max, I just want to tell you, thank you for coming on the Heart of Advice podcast. We appreciate your time and hopefully some people learned some new things today, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you guys for having me. This has been a blast.
Of course.
The Heart of Advice podcast is produced by eMoney Advisor, a leading provider of technology solutions and services that help people talk about money. Learn more at eMoneyAdvisor.com, where you can find additional resources for advisor success, including the Heart of Advice blog, as well as eBooks, CE webinars, and events.